This week, Russia's war on Ukraine escalates on both sides as they scramble for land ahead of possible peace talks.
This is all posturing and trying to make sure that they're in the best position possible when and if negotiations begin.
The International Criminal Court issues an arrest warrant for Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu on charges of crimes against humanity.
Israel will not recognize the validity of this decision. We will continue to do everything we must do to defend our citizens and defend our state.
Join us on the Voice of America as we explore the issues in the news.
Hello, I'm Scott Walterman in Washington.
And I'm Lori London.
It's expected that the new Trump administration may force Russia and Ukraine to sit down and negotiate. So in anticipation of that, both sides escalated their war efforts this past week.
Ukraine fired U.S. ATACMS missiles and British Storm Shadow cruise missiles into Russia for the first time. The U.S. says it will also provide Ukraine with more funding and U.S.-made landmines.
For its part, Russia fired a new generation of hypersonic missile at Ukraine. It's believed to be the first time the missile has ever been used on the battlefield. Alexander Grapp is a senior researcher at the Institute for Peace Research and Security Policy at the University of Hamburg.
I think we should be worried in the sense that this simply shows that we are in the midst of an arms race concerning different kinds of missiles, not only in Europe, but globally. And the problem in Europe with these kind of missiles, I think, is also reflected in Asia, where this process has already been going on for quite some time.
Joining us now to make sense of these developments is Jim Townsend, adjunct senior fellow at the Center for a New American Security Transatlantic Security Program.
Will any of this turn the tide?
It's rare for one system to turn the tide. Usually it's a number of different systems taken together. If applied, you know, an offensive that is tactically sound and this type of thing, that can turn the tide. But right now in Ukraine, so far, we've provided, you know, Abrams tanks, F-16s, HIMARS, and now, of course, the use of the ATACMS long-range missile, as well as other equipment, both from the U.S. and from Europe. You know, all of these things taken together are enabling Ukraine really to hold the line. And I think the most important thing about the ATACMS is that they're going to be needed to blunt this Russian offensive that is beginning to come together to try to get the Ukrainians out of Kursk. Using these long-range missiles, if they're used hopefully beyond Kursk, still unclear whether these are limited to just Kursk or into Russia outside of the Kursk, you know, salient there. If these can be used to impact the logistics that the Russians are going to need to be able to use to mount their offensive into the Kursk, if these missiles can be used to bomb logistics hubs, as well as some of the air bases that Russia uses, not just for strikes in Kursk, but also to launch drones or other aircraft to bomb these Ukrainian cities the way they've been doing, you know, that would be a tremendous help in this particular situation in Kursk. So to answer your question, they're not going to, you know, turn the tide, if you will, of the entire Russian operation, but taken together with other things that they've been given and used particularly to defend the Kursk salient there, it'll play a critical role. I just wish it had been done earlier, but better late than never.
So a lot of people think that what the strategy is now for both Russia and Ukraine is to simply keep or get as much territory as possible, given the possibility of negotiations when the Trump administration comes in. I read an article today, I think it was the New York Times, said that Russia's just throwing soldiers at the front line, sort of like they did on the Eastern Front in World War II. Just keep throwing bodies at the front line. Casualties are high, but they're inching forward, and their feeling is every inch they take, they get to keep potentially, should these negotiations come about. Do you agree with that analysis?
Yes, absolutely. I think there's a lot of posturing going on to try to be in the best place on the battlefield, in the best position, if and when negotiations begin. So I think that's absolutely right. I think that's one of the reasons the Russians are attacking that Ukrainian salient, you know, into Russia. They want to make sure that when they sit down at the table, that the Ukrainians don't possess any part of Russia, that they're not in control of something that might become a bargaining chip on the table. So they really want to clear Ukraine out of the Kursk salient. And like you point out, on the east, they're throwing Russian soldiers continually, and they have for months, to try to gain as much of those of that Donbas area as they possibly can. And, you know, I think when you talk about throwing Russian troops at the problem, that's what they're doing with the North Koreans, too. Those North Korean troops, they're just going to be cannon fodder. And so they're going to be thrown into the meat grinder in the Kursk salient. And they're going to experience a lot of casualties as well. But your point's very well taken. This is all posturing and trying to make sure that they're in the best position possible when and if negotiations begin.
Well, it does seem like the war is at a very volatile juncture. Where do you think this is going?
Well, I mean, that's the question that everyone is asking, and we're going to have to wait and see. For sure, Trump and others of his appointees have said that they're going to end that assistance. Biden, I think, released a package today of additional security assistance going to Ukraine. But the thinking is that pretty soon after taking office, Trump will have to deal with this point about continuing the assistance or not. And the question becomes, too, well, is he going to, do that for free? In other words, is he going to just, as a gift to Putin, withhold U.S. assistance to Ukraine and get nothing for it? Or will Trump say, look, this is my plan. I'm going to withhold assistance, but I'm not going to do it for free, Putin. I'm going to use this as leverage, and I want some things out of you, too. I mean, is this going to be part of trying to lay the foundations for what will be negotiations? And this particular bit of it would be leverage over Russia to make concessions as well. And so there's lots of speculation, lots of ideas. We just are not going to find out until he takes office and then actually does something. But I'd be really surprised if he's going to turn off the assistance and not get anything from it. I think he's going to use it for leverage on Russia in terms of a negotiated deal with Ukraine. But we'll have to wait and see.
We've heard a couple of different takes on what happens if the United States scales back or ends assistance to Ukraine. Do you think it's possible that Europe could pick up the slack?
Well, I don't think they'll be able to pick up the slack and completely fill the role of the U.S. I think there's a lot of stuff that's uniquely American, like the ATACMS, although there's Storm Shadow from the U.K. and the Scout missile that the French have. But there's a lot of things in terms of just the volume and the scale of assistance that really is something that we've been able to do out of the U.S. I think Europe will do the best it can in terms of providing assistance. I think there is certainly financial assistance that the EU wants to give. So there is help that's going to go to Ukraine. And Ukraine also, their own defense industry has been able to fill a lot of the needs in terms of drones and this kind of thing. The U.S. Has approved U.S. contractors to go in and do maintenance on a lot of the equipment that they already have. So they're not going to be left adrift. There's still going to be assistance there, but it's going to be more difficult. And I think it's going to eventually lead to sitting down at the negotiating table. I'm not sure when that is. But the U.S. not providing assistance is a blow. And Europe is going to have to really dig in to try to fill the gap as much as they can. But they won't be able to do as much as the U.S. has been able to do.
You know, also on Wednesday, Western embassies, including the U.S. embassy, the Greek embassy, the Italian, Spanish, maybe others, closed today due to concerns of intelligence over a potential threat. how unprecedented is it that in Kyiv, obviously, I should have said, how unprecedented is it for all of these embassies to close today in Kyiv? And what does this say? And what does it potentially mean?
Well, I found that also very interesting. I mean, Kyiv has been under threat and has received strikes in the past. It sounds like they must have gotten some intel that said that the embassies themselves might be targeted. I mean, I can only assume that's what they came up with. But we'll have to you know, see what happens tonight and then in the days to come. But I think it's certainly Putin putting the West on notice that providing attackums as well as other assistance is not going unnoticed in Moscow. And I think they're going to say, well, if you're going to do this, you're going to feel the effects of this war as well. So I think it's definitely a signal. We'll have to see. I hope they release what the intel was. But I think a lot of people sat up and took notice that suddenly Western embassies had to close based on some knowledge they had about these future strikes. So we might be seeing more of this as the Russians really act out their displeasure at things like attackums and storm shadow being provided to the Ukrainians.
Jim, thanks so much for the time.
Well, you're very welcome. Anytime.
Jim Townsend, adjunct senior fellow at the Center for a New American Security Transatlantic Security Program.
You're listening to Issues in the News. I'm Lori London with Scott Walterman.
The truth is simple. No war is more just than the war that Israel has been waging in Gaza after Hamas attacked us unprovoked, launching the worst massacre against the Jewish people since the Holocaust.
Calling it an anti-Semitic decision, Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu was defiant in his response to this week's decision by the International Criminal Court to issue an arrest warrant charging him with alleged war crimes. Here's Reuters correspondent Olivia Zelina with more.
The International Criminal Court issued arrest warrants on Tuesday for Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, his former defense chief, and a Hamas leader. The warrants are for alleged war crimes and crimes against humanity in the Gaza conflict. The move was met with outrage in Israel, while Hamas welcomed the warrants against the Israelis. In their decision, the ICC judges said there were reasonable grounds to believe Netanyahu and Yoav Gallant were criminally responsible for acts including murder, persecution, and starvation as a weapon of war, and said it was part of a, quote, widespread and systemic attack against the civilian population of Gaza. The warrants for Hamas leader Ibrahim al-Masri list charges of mass killings during the October 7, 2023 attacks on Israel. It also includes charges of rape and the taking of hostages. Israel said it killed Masri in an airstrike in July, but Hamas has neither confirmed nor denied it. The prosecution indicated it would continue to investigate his reported death. Netanyahu's office called the ICC decision anti-Semitic and said he would not yield until Israel's war objectives are met.
Why an arrest warrant against our prime minister?
In Tel Aviv, his supporters voiced disapproval.
You don't see the all anti-Semitism that's been going on, and the only state that's fighting it, that's fighting Hamas. We still have 101 hostages in captivity by Hamas.
A senior Hamas official told Reuters the warrants were a first step towards justice. But in Khan Yunis, displaced Palestinians said the decision to charge Netanyahu came too late.
He used October 7th as an excuse to commit crimes in the Gaza Strip. The Gaza Strip is not terrorists. It is children, elderly people, women.
Israel has rejected the jurisdiction of the Hague-based court and denies war crimes in Gaza. The United States, Israel's main diplomatic supporter, is also not a member of the ICC and rejected the decision on Thursday, said a White House National Security Council spokesperson. But others, like the EU's foreign policy chief, said the court's decision should be respected and implemented.
It is a decision of a court, of a court of justice, of an international court of justice.
The court does not have its own police force to carry out arrests and instead relies on its 124 member states. Israel's 13-month campaign has killed about 44,000 Palestinians and displaced nearly all the enclave's population, Gaza officials say. It launched the campaign in response to the October 7th attack, which killed 1,200 people and saw more than 250 hostages taken, Israel has said.
That was Reuters correspondent Olivia Zolino reporting.
So what does all this mean? Let's speak to an expert. Joining us now for some understanding is Leila Sadat, Washington University professor of international criminal law and special advisor on crimes against humanity to the ICC prosecutor.
Is this a groundbreaking decision?
Well, I think it's groundbreaking and it's not groundbreaking. I think right now the expectation of the international community when you see a conflict that appears to be raging out of control is that the ICC may be investigating. I think what's upsetting in the United States, where I live, obviously, is that Israel is a close ally to the United States of America, and Israel has allege that it's not committing the crimes that the prosecutor alleges are being committed. I would note that three Hamas leaders were also indicted by the prosecutor at the behest of Israeli nationals who actually flew to the court to ask the ICC to intervene in the situation. And the only way the ICC has jurisdiction over Hamas leaders is because the because Palestine had actually ratified the Rome Statute. So I think that it's unfortunate that two of the Hamas officials were executed. There is one remaining individual whose whereabouts and viability are unknown. And so the court also issued the arrest warrants against Daif.
How unusual is it that a Western nation's leader has been indicted by the court?
Well, Slobodan Milosevic was probably one of the first Western leaders to be indicted by an international criminal tribunal. It was the Yugoslavia tribunal, not the ICC, but he obviously was the president of the Federal Republic of Yugoslavia. And the Nuremberg trials, which are the genesis of the entire international criminal justice project over the last 75 years, are clearly the genesis that, you know, and it was Germans who were indicted. So no one is above the law. And it's just as simple as that.
The judges said there were reasonable grounds to believe that the blockade on Gaza, the lack of food, water, electricity, et cetera, created conditions of life calculated to bring about the destruction of part of the civilian population in Gaza. Would this be a classic case of crimes against humanity? And how is that different from genocide?
Oh, that's a great question. So genocide is, in a way, the most challenging of the three core ICC crimes to charge, because you have to show that the accused intended to destroy in whole or in part a racial, religious, national, or ethnic group. And that specific intent requirement, as well as the group intent requirement, is very challenging. What you need to prove for a crime against humanity, whether it be murder or extermination or sexual violence, which is also alleged against Hamas, for example, is you have to show an attack that is widespread or systematic against a civilian population. But you don't have to show the discriminatory intent of the accused to do it in order to execute or to exterminate the group. So crimes against humanity are hard to prove, but genocide is probably the most challenging to prove.
The court really has no teeth, right? I mean, if your country is a member of the court, you're supposed to detain a suspect facing a warrant if they set foot on your soil. But the court has no way to enforce that.
States are required to cooperate with ICC arrest warrants. And so Omar al-Bashir, for example, the former president of Sudan, who's now in jail, jailed by his own people. But when Bashir was under an ICC arrest warrant, he did flaunt the warrant by traveling widely. And there were states, even ICC states, that refused to arrest him. That said, he then traveled to South Africa, which has a very vibrant legal system. And even though the South African government had allowed him to participate in the meetings he was there for, the courts actually ordered his arrest. And he had to leave extremely suddenly in order to avoid arrest in South Africa. So the European states, you know, we have arrest warrants out for Vladimir Putin, for Maria Lvova-Belova, for four top generals in the Russian military. And I'm sure there are arrest warrants that we don't know about because they're under seal. The Europeans are going to implement those warrants if those individuals are on their soil. They have a robust ability to do so. So would somebody from an ally state be able to exert enough political influence to get the courts and the police to back down? Possibly, for sure. But that's not really the way interstate arrest warrants work now, is they do get implemented even against very high-ranking officials.
Do you think that the decision, particularly when it comes to Netanyahu and Gallant in particular, will complicate things, further isolate them, or will it have any practical implications?
I think these have practical implications. They don't happen immediately. And that's always the challenge with international justice. It took a very, very long time to apprehend Mladic, Karadzic. It took a very, very long time to apprehend many of the most significant indictees of the Yugoslavia Tribunal. It took a long time to get Charles Taylor in the dock for the Special Court of Sierra Leone. In national systems, think of Israel trying Adolf Eichmann. That happened in the 1960s. Israelis had to wait a long time in order to get the individual accused, right, and then convicted of being the author of the final solution in the dock. So international criminal justice, because the cases are complicated, because the accused have high rank, I think they, in a way, appropriately take a long time. You wouldn't want this to be a hasty process because it has to be measured. It has to be judicious. The evidence really has to be overwhelming beyond a reasonable doubt in order for somebody of this high position to be appropriately indicted and convicted by an international court. So in a way, the system is maybe frustratingly, but it's frustratingly slow by design. It's not meant to be on a fast track.
So would it also be pretty serious evidence to get to the point where they've even gone where they have?
Oh, absolutely. Oh, my gosh. No ICC prosecutor wants to have egg on their face and have an acquittal after having taken the political courage. And it did take political courage because we saw what happened in the Afghanistan situation when the Trump administration actually sanctioned the ICC prosecutor under the IEEPA. So it took a certain degree of political courage in order for Karim Khan to do this and for the judges to issue the warrants, knowing that there's sanctions bills right now threatening in the U.S. Congress. And nobody takes that kind of decision lightly. So I think the one thing you can say about this is the evidence was carefully parsed, carefully measured, carefully looked at, and it was not something that was done lightly at all.
Let's say that they actually do get Netanyahu in court. What happens then?
The trial happens in a way just like in the United States. The prosecutor presents their evidence, the defense presents their evidence, but at the ICC, the victims also get to present evidence, which is different. And that's why it's such a shame that we don't have the Hamas accused, I think, who are realistically going to be, at least not these accused in this case, because the victims obviously want their day in court as well.
Well, we appreciate your taking the time to speak with us. Thank you so much.
Thank you. And I hope that was helpful. It was great to be with you.
Leila Sadat, Washington University professor of international criminal law and special advisor on crimes against humanity to the ICC prosecutor.
And that's all the time we have this week. On behalf of all of us here at VOA, thanks so much for listening.
For more news throughout the week, listen to our podcast, The Issue. It's available on our website, voanews.com, and also wherever you get your podcasts.
Join us next week for more Issues in the News. Until then, I'm Lori London.
And I'm Scott Walterman.